the 2-2. And a curveball to get him and end the inning. The fourth strikeout of the night for Max Scherzer, quite possibly his last pitch. And a handshake from John Schneider and Pete Walker and a lot of high fives from his teammates. So Scherzer is clearly done. 5 innings, 3 runs on 6 hits. Walk 3, struck out 4.
The pitch, he squares, he bunts third base side, and a beauty. The catcher, Heinemann, up with it, no play! Everybody's safe! He looked to third, he looked to first, and he didn't throw anywhere! And everybody on their feet, nobody out, for guess who? Jose Ramirez, batting right-handed.
This was not moving.
Lined in the left, a base hit, and that's the ball game. The Guardians walk it off at the bottom of the 10th on an RBI single.
They get their walk-off win number 4, and they knock off the Jays 5-4 in 10 innings.
Seen Stephen Kwan get plenty of hits, you know, against righties and lefties, so just wanted to get an out there. Just looking at it quickly, I haven't talked to Heine or Hemi. Just wanted to, I think Hemi would have gotten there. Just want to get that out. Walk Jose, take your chances. You know, it's one of those things where I think if Heine could do it over again, he probably throws it over to first base.
Yeah, not an ideal finish. That was not the point of the game, though. Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis, Brent Gunning. Yeah, you want to win all the baseball games, but you also want Max Scherzer to survive. And sometimes you can't have both. And I think the Blue Jays, if they had their druthers, they'd be satisfied with that result as opposed to the other way around, because Max Scherzer did throw 80-plus pitches. Blue Jays do lose, though, 5-4 to the Guardians. Max Scherzer was as positive as I've seen him, heard him after the game. Now, today is the day, though. How's the thumb hanging in there? But he got through more than 3 innings, which is something we couldn't have said about him in his Blue Jays career before yesterday.
No, and I will be honest, hand up, after Stephen Kwan, I don't know if it quite got to double digits, but it's at least a 9-pitch at bat at that first at bat of the game. I'm going, I don't know if like 75 has been the threshold. I'm just doing some quick math here. I don't know how deep into this thing he's going to get. And Stephen Kwan's a guy who's going to battle. You love that he gets to end it with that moment of the curveball K at the end there. Just a lot to like. And yeah, mostly that Max Scherzer survived. Again, it's like he didn't pour cold water on it, but that's like more a today or tomorrow thing. But from the, not the first time, but from the second time of Max Scherzer, way better than the first time. I liked it a lot better. So obviously not perfect. Obviously some things to build on there, but more than 3 innings and not having dead thumb as far as we know. So all check marks for me.
Brent, not even just like tepid, like, yeah, I'm okay, we'll have to see. And we will have to see. Again, today is the big day. It's the recovery day after the start. Here's a direct quote. How did he feel about the physical side of his start? Very good. Very good.
Wow.
Very, Max, you know, that sets us up to think that, you know, you might be all right. You might actually make your next start, which, yeah, fingers crossed is the case. The performance, you're right, like that first at bat, Stephen Kwan making it seem like this is going to be yet another short outing for Max Scherzer, and he gives up the one run in the first inning and eventually 3. But no, he looked the part, man. It was not the best start of his career by any stretch of the imagination, but I think the most encouraging thing, if we're just taking my incredible scouting eyes and applying them to the start, is throwing the ball really fast. Like not old school Max Scherzer 99, but 95 on his 81st pitch of the game. He was throwing 95. The breaking ball quite often was in the zone, not as often as he wanted, obviously, right? Like that to me feels like a rust thing. That's just, you know, get back out there a couple more times and you can fine tune that stuff. The raw stuff, though, 95, the almost 41-year-old on his 81st pitch. To me, I'm sold as long as the thumb stays together today.
Yeah, it is. It is very, very much dependent on said thumb and how it feels this morning. You go velocity. I'll go location. Yeah, okay. The breaking ball missing on occasion. You know, he's getting guys looking on the black with fastball at 95. Like I think there was a lot to like out of that start, and it's that you're right. Like the things that didn't. that didn't look like they were going maybe the best for Scherzer, those things feel like rust things, whereas all of the stuff that you'd want to see, the raw tools, can he, get a pitch where he needs it to be at a given time? Is he able to work effectively deeper into the start? I think those are all things that you see that should be a massive, massive positive out of this one. And honestly, it's like, given the results that you saw, the only way it wasn't going to feel like one is if Scherzer did what he's done every other time he's touched a baseball since we've seen him be a Blue Jay, being like, I don't know, and he didn't do that. So no, I don't know where, like let's play, like I'm trying to, I love to get into the other side of the argument. Like, what is it? I don't even know how you could make the argument that this is anything other than super, super encouraging.
Well, if you were gonna quibble, you'd be like, 9 base runners in 5 innings, you're paying this fella over $15 million. Now again, this is not me, but
yeah.
Brent, there is another side of it. I would say, yeah, that's fine for a guy coming off the injured list who's about to be 41. Just getting his feet wet back in the major leagues. Albeit, and then that other person, again, I'm going to argue with the straw man person.
Yep.
Although it's not a straw man, maybe this person does exist somewhere, probably not amongst the Blue Jays fan base. They might say, yeah, the Guardians, not exactly the 1927 New York Yankees as far as their offense is concerned. And you might say, yeah, that's fine. You'd also say, shut up. But yeah, I think when this Max Scherzer signing occurred, nobody thought you were acquiring a Cy Young contender. Nobody thought you were acquiring a top of the rotation starter. What they thought you were acquiring is like a mid rotation starter, not a back end of the rotation starter. Like, I think anything north of an ERA, honestly, over 4 is slightly disappointing, like not abhorrent. But if Max Scherzer has an ERA under 4, and honestly, he can just take the ball from this point forward and every fifth day make starts for the Blue Jays, I think you're pleased as punch. The expectations I had for performance for Max Scherzer, I thought was pretty reasonable. I think for most people it's pretty reasonable that they understand it at almost 41 years old. Max Scherzer's not that guy that is going into the Hall of Fame. He's some version of, honestly, like, who, if we just take him and Kevin Gausman the rest of the season and say who's going to have the better performance every fifth day, I think it's a conversation.
Yeah, it's a conversation. If you want Scherzer, you're getting some odds there, I think. But yeah, it is a conversation. I think I'm likely taking Gausman there. But I don't know. Let's see 2 more starts like this, or maybe he's able to limit a walk or a hard hit ball here or there. And yeah, it's absolutely a conversation between those guys. And I think that's the important thing that you point out there. You know, I think you have to understand what it is. That, you know, Scherzer was not going to be, you know, short of everybody else on this staff, you know, turning into dust right before our eyes, I don't think he was going to be the number 2 starter on this team. Like, best case scenario was number 3 starter for Scherzer in the way you would have set it up. And I don't even know that you're asking him to be that, given what you've got out of Bassett at various times this year. So yeah, it is an important building block for the Jays, and they need to figure out the rotation, right? This has been something that's been talked about. You know, I know Passam was on with Laren Barker yesterday saying, they could go get a starter and they can go get a bat. Okay. Well, like, maybe if it's less a volume issue with the starter you need to go and acquire, maybe it could be like a quality thing, and you can now actually shop in like a slightly deeper end of the pool. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see the ripple effects of if this is real from Scherzer.
Yeah, I think what we're now understanding, and I was mostly of this belief, that if Max Scherzer is healthy, that's the biggest question, obviously. And maybe it wasn't everybody's biggest question going into this year. Maybe it was the performance. But now it remains my only question about Max Scherzer. Because I think if he's taking the ball every fifth day, he's not going to embarrass himself out there. It's not going to be a situation where it's like, oh, yeah, nobody actively like just decides to walk away from pro sports. They have to be dragged away kicking and screaming. Even a guy with a resume and a career like Max Scherzer, it's got to be like apparent that he can't perform anymore. And nobody's offering him anything, and then he'll walk away. I don't see that happening this season. Maybe I should knock on wood. He's not going to embarrass himself out there. Like, again, the stuff is like, if Max Scherzer is throwing 95, pretty sure he can get by with that level of diminished velocity. Like, Kevin Gausman, again, to take another, like, Kevin Gausman is kind of living at 95 these days. So, yeah, I think if you were trepidatious about the Scherzer signing because you thought, boy, $15 million is a lot, because even if he's healthy, there's like a Bowden Francis outcome here where it's like, oh my God, this is the lasting image of Max Scherzer when he retires. It's like, we'll just want to forget about this season because it's so ugly. It's such a stain on his career. It's not, because it's just one season. But I don't think, I feel pretty confident that that's not going to be the case this year. If it goes belly up, if it goes pear-shaped, it's because of injury, not because Max Scherzer doesn't have anything left in the tank anymore.
Yeah, that's it. I you know, as rosy as it is today, I don't want to be the one to do this, but it's like, I'm not totally ruling that possibility out because he got through one start. Like, I want to see what happens today. I want to see what happens when you've been through, you know, the rigmarole of doing this all five times. So I think that, yeah, it you should not be waiting for the other shoe to drop performance wise, but I think it is a fair, you know, to be a little to have a little trepidation when it comes to the injury stuff. Again, like, just ask him at any point in time up until what, 3 days ago.
Yeah, absolutely. So Blue Jays lose the game. You want to win all the baseball games. That's the point of stepping onto the field, is the winning. And they almost did. Almost another incredible comeback. They ended up taking the lead after trailing 3-1 in the baseball game, because George Springer once again came through with the big hit, but they couldn't come through with the second big hit with the bases loaded. One out in the eighth inning. Yeah, that's going to happen. It would have been ideal to have Alejandro Kirk still in the game instead of Tyler Heineman in extra innings as well, but I understand taking your shot when you do have the bases loaded with one out and an opportunity to break the game wide open. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. also hit a home run, and that's not like that noteworthy, except when, and it wasn't the four-seamer, but it was like a cutter at like the mid-90s at least. Every time I see Vladimir Guerrero Jr. pull a ball in the air and it goes over the fence and it's a high velocity pitch, it warms my heart, because it's just, it feels like something different is happening there. It feels like there's a different mentality whenever Vlad does that. And it's not that he's chasing power, but that he's open to, yeah, not just slashing everything the other way for a 120 mile an hour single.
It's so funny, the semantics of this, right? Like, I think we all agree we don't want him to chase power. But God, when he gets aggressive, when there's a chance to, it's like, I don't know. Is that much different than chasing power? I don't know that it is. Yeah, you love to see that. That's a sexy bomb. Like, they aren't always. Sometimes they're kind of the low, you know, the low line drive that it's like, oh, that thing did get over. Look at that. No, that wasn't that last night. Turned on it. You love to see it. And yeah, it was just, it's a refreshing sign to see him hit a home run where it looks like, and again, it's like, these things don't matter. It goes over the fence or it doesn't, but aesthetically there is, and you know, you paint out all the baseball cases for it, but just aesthetically, it's nice for him to hit a home run that looks like what your $500 million player is supposed to look like. Like, if I just showed up on Earth and I sat down on my couch at, I don't know, like 7:12 or whatever time that was, and was like, hey, that guy's worth $500 million. I would say, yeah, okay. I mostly agree with that. And you know, baseball is not the sport that lends itself to that. It's like, you could watch a lot of game time without these guys doing it, but it was nice to have for him to have that moment where he looked like that guy.
Yeah, a couple of micro moments in the game that I kind of want to delve into. One was, okay, so Springer comes up with the huge two-run game tying single in the sixth, and then they take the lead because mostly because of an incredible challenge. It's like they got the Leafs video guys during the offseason to extend their season throughout the summer. The neighborhood play at second base, which is, boy, you take that video and you show it to someone from 20 years ago and you're like, this is what baseball will become, that they probably vomit in their own hat. But the reason it exists is because you can't take anybody out at second base, so there's no reason to fear for your ankles and knees by just standing at second base with your foot on the bag and receiving the ball. And rightly they challenge, and rightly it's overturned. And then Alejandro Kirk scoring on the shallowest fly ball he will ever score on in his career. It's a great send. Brent, you said, like, oh, you don't talk about Carlos Fabelis at third base as third base coach. Well, I want to give credit to Carlos Fabelis. That was an awesome send because, yeah, like even Alejandro Kirk with some of the slowest foot speed in all of Major League Baseball can scamper home if the guy catching the fly ball is sliding and then has to turn and flip it back towards home plate. That was an incredible send. Incredible job by the replay guys in the dugout. Just all around great job. Unfortunately, they couldn't hold the lead, but yeah, great job by the Blue Jays in that moment.
Yes, yes. For the Blue Jays, absolutely. I will say I loathe that I loathe that replay of like, oh, we're going to slow it down and his foot's a millimeter. It's like, it's the rule. It's the right call. I'm not begrudging anything here. It's just like in my world, in my sensibilities. It's the same thing with the NHL. It's like I hate slowing it down to, you know, 1/1000th of a second. It's like, oh, the steal was a quarter of a millimeter off the ice. Come on, we know what it is. So I agree. Great job by the Blue Jays. Just like for my sensibilities, it's like if we have to, you know, get down to like what did an ant see here, I think we've kind of lost the plot a little bit. But yes, great call there, and great call by Fabulous. Great job by Kirk hustling. You just love to see a guy like that when he's got to move it. Okay, there's just fun things in sports, and that is one of them. He's safe. You love to see it. And yeah, it's unfortunate that he had already been taken out of the game when his spot comes up, but you know, you might not have been in that spot if things work out differently in that way. So you take your shot. Do not begrudge them there. And I do not begrudge Fabulous, and good job by you making a point to give him his due as a good third base coach.
Yeah, I guess good job by Vladdy to do the funny thing when the slow guy like scores or runs a lot to do the towel like waving in his face to cool him off. But you do that like when a guy like scores from first on a double,
right,
or has a triple. Like he literally just ran 90 feet. That's it. Like that's like literally the shortest amount that you're going to do. Unless you strike out, you're doing that on every single at bat. Like probably.
Right.
Probably overdoing it with the towel in that moment.
Well, and also, I got to be honest, it's like, I know he's Mr. like prop, right? Like, he loved the jacket. He loves to be in the middle of this. He loves a water cooler. But it's like, isn't that the job of like an Ernie Clement or an out? Like, you know, usually it's like the fast guy who's doing that. I don't know that it's like often from your hulking first baseman type that's doing that. I feel like it's usually like opposite ends of the spectrum that play into that joke.
Yeah, for sure. Kudos to Jeff Hoffman for a scoreless inning and hitting 98 as well. He needed that. Like it's one of those situations. I think he's still the closer as of this moment right now. I would have thought that without that appearance, but now that he has that appearance, definitely. Like if it had been another rocky outing for Jeff Hoffman and we saw more 95s than 98s yesterday, I think it's very possible that today's afternoon rubber match, it's Uriel Rodriguez in the highest leverage moments of the game. But yeah, that's the best version of Jeff Hoffman, the Jeff Hoffman we saw in April, still in there. It's just less consistent than it was the first month of the season.
Yep, certainly was. I know they were talking a little bit on the post game about like, could you have gone back to him? Let's not play with fire here, guys. Like it went well. Let's move on. I do not begrudge them going to Fluharty in that spot. I suppose Rodriguez would have been another option there, but the idea of going back to Hoffman, they've got a lot of six out saves from him, and when he was doing that on the reg, he looked like a bit of a different guy. So no, I think it was important for him to have that bounce back, but no, that would have been he was already I think at 20 pitches or just shy of it. So it would have been maybe malpractice is strong, but I would have felt a little malpractice-y to send Hoffman back out there.
No, 100%. He was at 18 pitches, and yes, when he was earning his place in many Blue Jays fans' hearts early in the season, it was because he was doing things exactly like he could have done yesterday with the six outs and getting the job done in the bottom of the 10th inning after the Blue Jays theoretically had scored in the top of the 10th. But if it's just, you know, it not correlation and causation, or if it actually is the result of the downturn in performance and velocity, that he was overworked early in the season. Either way, I don't need to roll the dice on that happening for the rest of the season against the Guardians in late June. Like, I know these are all very important games, and the Blue Jays in a sliding door scenario could have shut down the Guardians and then won the game in the 11th inning. Yeah, it wasn't a game that you felt like it was do or die, like got to win this game where we've lost 10 straight and this is to break the losing streak or some insanity. Like you want to win every baseball game, but this is the nature of Major League Baseball. There's 162 of these things. And yeah, you do have to think bigger picture with Jeff Hoffman. And clearly you need to protect him a little bit more than they have this season.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you like? We've been pretty high on Fluharty this year. Do you like? I don't even know how to phrase this question that doesn't sound insulting yeah. to your baseball intelligence. It's like no one's panicking. Mason Fluharty had a bad outing, but you have the lefties come up in that spot. It's not 2007, so that's not like his job anymore. But you know, kind of his job. What do you like make of the Fluharty outing?
Yeah, I think it's a natural part of a young player, a rookie player's development here that he's hitting a bit of a bump in the road. That's an impossible spot as well. And I didn't see how they messaged what happened on the bunt by Fry, but clearly they had like a wheel play on. I don't think Jimenez got to first base in time. Like I think that was what was holding Heinemann up from throwing to first base. There was nobody there. Like Vlad was charging hard. Obviously you walk Stephen Kwan because you don't want to pitch to him, even lefty on lefty, because he's going to get a base hit pretty clearly, or at the very least put a ground ball in a place that is going to advance the runner. Yeah, in an alternate reality, you're not pitching to Jose Ramirez because that'd be good, but you had to. So, it's a tough spot for Mason Fluharty in a situation where you're probably going to lose the game. That's what happens when you don't when you're in extra innings. And you don't score your run in the top of the 10th, and the home team gets to start with their base runner on second base. It's a dire proposition. I'm not out on Mason Fluharty. I think this will actually be very interesting to see how he bounces back after a couple of subpar outings, and whether he has the mental makeup to get past this and trust his stuff, because I do believe that the stuff is good, and I don't think he's gonna be prime BJ Ryan necessarily or Billy Wagner. He can probably help this team as the second lefty, and especially as the bullpen gets a little healthier. Nick Sandlin needs to get back to the Nick Sandlin that we saw in his early tenure with the Blue Jays as well. I tend to think that's a rust thing because, you know, he's still getting swing and miss. I think ultimately Mason Fluharty will be probably where he should be, which is more in like middle relief as opposed to high leverage.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense, and that's still like great find, right? Like that's the important part to sit on. It's not to like take the pressure off of him. It's not to say you can't ask more, but I mean, if I would have just told you that they've found a lefty guy that they've taken in a recent draft, high pick, and he's going to be able to make a difference for this team in some way, shape, or form, you wouldn't say, well, hold on, is it high leverage relief? Is it like a number one or two starter? I don't want that then. No, you'd be happy to have it. So it's not to put a ceiling on him, but it is to remind you of what kind of found money feels strong for like a third or fourth round pick. But it's important to have.
All right, a couple more pitching notes before we take the break. So to make room for Max Scherzer on the roster, the Blue Jays DFA'd Spencer Turnbull, which is, like, I guess not a big deal. But to me, I think it's a great sign that this is a guy with recent major league track record. Obviously, injuries have hampered him recently, and was not there's not a huge financial commitment to him, but somebody that you could have seen, like, given a longer runway, be an effective pitcher. But Blue Jays didn't like what they saw. They didn't like the performance. They didn't like the stuff. And they don't have time to sit around and wait for Spencer Turnbull to be good. So see you later, Spencer Turnbull. So I whenever a team in a contention in a window of contention, which the Blue Jays are, whether you think that's for the division or a playoff spot or the World Series, that when decisions are made in the best interest of the winning of baseball games as opposed to the retention of assets, I'm all for it.
Yeah, that's the way they should be going about their business. I'm very, very happy to know that this is not a Ryan Yarbrough situation for you. Because, like, honestly, like, I think you're good to have one of those guys. I can't live in a world where there's two. So I'm just happy to know, like, we have it on record here.
Yeah.
If Spencer Turnbull ends up good somewhere else, it's like you were wrong, too.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah. Because he didn't show that he was capable of getting major league hitters out again. Ryan Yarbrough was last time we saw him, and in spring training. and then was. He's on the IL now for the Yankees, though, as well. Okay, lastly. So, Trey Yosevich, I can't stop talking about him because, yeah, he's really good. And he had two starts before yesterday in AA, and one was pretty good. One was not as good. And yesterday he had his best start yet, and it was, like, shockingly good in AA. Five innings, one hit, one walk, no runs, eight strikeouts. Brent, he is now second in the minor leagues in strikeouts with 104. He is just racking them up. It hasn't all been perfect. Boy, the lower levels of the minors have been pretty close to perfect. But now that you've shown maybe your best start yet in the minor leagues, going as deep as he did in AA, which is, there are prospects that come straight from AA to the major leagues. It makes me think about how many more of these he needs before he gets to AAA, and then how many does he need in AAA before he is forcing the Blue Jays' hand at the major league level. Like, this is, if you go back to the Reds prospect we talked about yesterday and the path for him, it was like three AA starts and a couple of AAA. So what, two more of these in AA and maybe one or two in AAA? And it's a path that's already been forged by his first round draft compatriots.
Yeah, it's uber exciting. It's one thing for a guy to have success. It's another thing for a guy to have success punching people out, right? If your strikeouts travel, and it allows you to dream on what you're able to see from him there. Yeah, you mentioned the Reds prospect Chase Burns already, saw him make his debut, second pick, as opposed to, I think, Yosevich was 20th, 24th, somewhere in and around there for him. But no, this is uber exciting. I guess my question for you on it is, like, is the Turnbull, like, that's not, they're not connected in that they DFA'd Turnbull yesterday because Trey Yosevich had a good start, but are they connected in that they can see the path to Yosevich being here and it makes it that much easier to cut the cord on Turnbull? That's the question I have about it.
Yeah, I think they're just acquiring more guys that are league average as far as the bulk relievers go, because they acquired this fella, Robinson Pena, who has actually already pitched in the major leagues, albeit like one outing, and then he was immediately DFA'd, which is a little curious. But no, I think they feel like they have more options, especially with Adam Macko. Like, there are guys ahead of Yosevich in the pecking order. If, God forbid, the thumb is still ailing Max Scherzer today, Yosevich is never, I would be, it's a hard scenario for me to imagine that the Blue Jays are like desperate for a starter, and it's like, we turn our lonely eyes to you, Trey Yosevich, this season. No, it's a situation where it's like, oh, here's an improvement on our rotation. Here's a guy that can help us. And it's not a, oh my God, we need somebody. Who's the best option out there? Maybe Yosevich, like, he's been pretty good. I'm not 100% sure. No, there's other guys to fill that role. Trey Yosevich, it's an upside play. It's like, oh, we can't acquire. There are no top of the rotation or big swing and miss guys out of the bullpen available in trade. So let's look internally. We actually have one of those guys, and it's Trey Yosevich.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. I guess the other path that I think is interesting is, like, does how high end he is as a starting prospect, or at least how it feels right now, and how quick the path feels, does that, like, almost eliminate him coming up as that, like, David Price we talked about? And I'm not talking about the time of the season, but just, like, if you're going to bring him up, you'd bring him up to start games. Like, that's the fascinating part now, is because I will be honest, it's like, even having this conversation, I swear to God, yesterday with you, Ben, I'm thinking of, like, okay, you know, later in the season, he's like that relief weapon. I feel like with how valuable he could be to the org, it's not that you couldn't use him that way, but you're not going to neuter half a season of starting development to have that for him. That's the interesting part for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The issue will be the innings, right? Because last season in college, he threw only 93 and a third already this season, and we're not yet in July, and he hopes to have a long runway ahead of him. He's thrown 62 and a third. Like, he's like, two-thirds of the way to his career high in innings already. So I think it would be a situation where, like, at no point this season is Trey Yosevich ever throwing 100 pitches in a baseball game. Right. And at some point, yeah, as much as I think most franchises, including the Blue Jays, want to fast-track their pitching prospects because their arms are always on the verge of exploding, and never being the same. I don't think anybody takes somebody whose career high in innings is 93 and say, okay, 200 it is. Like, there are incremental steps here, and I think as limited as the information is about what causes pitcher arm injuries and Tommy John surgeries, the one thing that seems universally true, not always true, but the most true, is that when you have a huge innings jump year over year, that's pretty risky for somebody's arm. So that would be the reason that he's probably, if he's arriving as a Blue Jay, it's probably not as like just a every fifth day starting pitcher throwing 80 to 100 pitches. It's probably at the end of his season and, okay, you know what? We got a couple bullets left in the chamber. Let's save those at the major league level. Punch some people out in 20 pitch stints.
Yeah, I sign me up. Sounds good. I'm very interested in that.
Yep, me too. All right, Blue Jays and Guardians, a rubber match this afternoon on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan. When we come back, sign me up for more Project 6-9, I guess. That's what the Raptors appear to be doing. Although Colin Murray Boyles is only 6'6", so maybe they're pivoting. Project 6-6. We'll get into...
Does he want to be signed up? Does he want to be conscripted?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that and more next as the Fan Morning Show continues. Ben Ennis, Brent Gunning, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With the ninth pick in the 2025 NBA Draft, the Toronto Raptors select Colin Murray Boyles from the University of South Carolina.
I think as a sophomore, you know, we had 2 years to evaluate him, so someone that we identified last year, he decided to stay in school, sort of had our eye on him going into the season. I think for those of you who watched him, I think, you know, very obvious elite defense, really versatile, great hands, a lot of stocks. So I think for us, it was the defense versatility, but we felt, you know, he has a chance to be a really, really good defender in the NBA. I do think the one thing that gets you on the court as a rookie is your defense. And so I think that gives him a leg up, but no, expectations will always be managed as far as, listen, he's not only adjusting to coming to the NBA and playing basketball, it's the lifestyle stuff, it's off the court. There's so many more requirements here. You're not in school anymore. Where are you going through time? So I think we're always cognizant of the other stuff that they're adjusting to as well. So, you know, we'll have the realistic expectations for them.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Brent Gunning. That was Raptors General Manager Bobby Webster talking about the ninth overall selection, Colin Murray Boyles from South Carolina, 6'6 forward, and defense first fella. Shooting? Who knows? Not so good. In his second year in college, 26.5% from three, but he's rangy. He's a versatile defender. Can defend multiple positions. He's a wing. Like he fits the mold of a lot of Raptors players at the moment. And a fella that was you can't go entirely on these mock drafts, but most people had him mocked in around 13. And the Raptors get him at 9. What was your initial reaction, Brent?
My initial reaction is like, wait a minute, that's not the big center from Duke. I thought that's what was happening here. That was my honest-to-God first-blush reaction. There has been so much connection with Masai Ujiri. The Raptors always seeming to covet a big. There's some pedigree connection there just with the program. And then they flash their little highlight pack of Mr. Murphy Boyles on the screen, and you get it in about all of 3 seconds. I don't say I get the pick and that I couldn't have been talked into something else, but you see what they see. They show a highlight pack in which there are three or four different instances of him switching on to defend three or four different guys on ball in the same clip. So you totally get the switchability stuff. You understand that he's a good scorer at the rim. You know, how does that translate from college to the NBA is a massive question. And then the shooting thing, right? It is of the, mm-hmm. you know, this org has been of the belief that they can create shooters. They once upon a time were able to do that. I'm still kind of waiting a little bit in terms of the more current crop. But if they think that that's something that can be developed, then yeah, you know, they've tried paying for the shooting, right? That's what Grady Dick was. You're paying for the shooting and then hoping the other stuff comes. They're going the other way with this pick. So I think that's actually, to me, the most interesting interesting thing is that in the span of just a couple of years, they've been in a relatively similar lottery spot and chose to take. And again, like, you know, the cards come to you how they come to you. I don't think the two drafts are exactly the same in that regard. But it's just interesting that with Dick, they're like, OK, the shooter is here. Let's take him. And then with Murphy Boyles, it's like, all right, you know, we can find a shooter. Sure. But look at this guy. He can't shoot. So he must be good if we're going to take him.
Cameron Malawak is going to be the name that people are rightly, I think, monitoring here. The center from Duke, the big center from Duke that you were talking about, who was very emotional upon being selected immediately following the Raptors' selection of Colin Murray Boyles at 9. He ends up in Phoenix in a trade. And yeah, that seemed like positionally, skill set wise, like that was the guy. But nope, the Raptors defer to the switchable defender, which I guess you could say that they did at number four when they selected Scottie Barnes. That worked out. It hasn't been perfect, though, since 2019 for this Raptors team. Like, where is your level of faith in Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster to make the right decision here?
It's not overly high. I don't say that as though it's been some disaster, right? Like, I was somebody hands up who was like, I thought we were supposed to take Jalen Suggs. What happened here? So, like, it's not to say that they haven't had their moments when they've been proven right in this. They've also drafted Grady Dick in the same amount of time, and it hasn't, you know, taken off. There were some strides last year that you like to see. It's not so much about the drafting. You know, these two things are always in concert, but it feels to me like the development part has been what's fallen off, not so much that they haven't been necessarily selecting the right player. So, the faith isn't where it once was, but I think because of the Barnes hit, and again, it was at 4, it's a different thing, but they went off the board to grab the guy they thought they should have, and, you know, I still have my questions about whether that's like the lead dog of a, you know, championship or, you know, one tier team in the NBA. But that was obviously a good selection that they made there. So the bloom is a little off the rose. I don't look at it the way I once did, where it's like, okay, the Raptors took a guy. They must have seen something here. I see what they see. But yeah, when there's just the positional need and the guy goes and Mualak goes right behind where you're at. Yeah, it's I think a lot of people rightfully so have some questions about this one.
A lot of Steve Francis trending yesterday.
Oh, why? What happened?
Because Mr. Murray Boyles let loose an expletive upon finding out that the Raptors had selected him at 4. It seemed really bad, like in the moment. And then he lets the expletive go, and then he does turn to his family and I think his girlfriend. Anyways, he hugs everybody and he seems happy enough. And then people were unearthing, like, immediately, hey, no, when the Raptors met with him and he met with the media, he was like talking about how great a fit he would be. And even yesterday, he was talking about, oh, the Raptors would be a great place for me. So, hey, everybody, don't forget, we'll play you a clip in a second from his media availability yesterday addressing exactly what happened. But, Brett, that was, oh, man, this Raptors fan base is a very insecure one, even in the best of moments. In 2019, it seemingly did nothing to erase that. But yeah, I think you are forgiven if you had some anxiety in that moment when he let loose the four-letter word.
Yeah, he didn't look happy, man. He stood up. He like kind of buttoned his jacket or unbuttoned his jacket, and he's, ah, bleep, is what it looked like happened there. And then, yeah, you know, he's going to come out and he's not an idiot. He's going to say the right things. And it's not that he's never professed these things before, but man, it's also different. Like, it, generally speaking, the travel for basketball goes kind of one way on this border, right? Like, there are a lot of Canadian kids who go ply their trade in the States as early as high school at these prep schools. It's not going the other way. You know, it's not like hockey where these kids are coming up here for tournaments all the time. And it's like, oh, yeah, I've been to Toronto a million times. I went to Edmonton for the Brick. No, it doesn't work that way. So, yeah, I get the, anxiety, or maybe that's not the right term, but, you know, a little hesitancy on his part. And it's like, come on, man. Like, there's one, and it's me. I kind of get it. But, yeah, I don't like it, and I feel the same reaction that everybody else felt watching it in the moment, for sure.
All right, here is Colin Murray Boyles after that moment. He had a number of minutes to collect himself. Here he is meeting with the assembled media, I believe digitally, after the draft.
Just disbelief, you know. Like, Toronto was probably my first team that I worked out for. But that what I said was not a bad thing by any means. Just very thankful for it. That was like a surreal moment, like to hear my name called and by this organization that has a good history and have really good players as of right now. It was just a crazy moment. Obviously thankful for the opportunity that they give me, and taking it full on. I'm ready to do whatever it needs or whatever they need me to do. So.
I believe that. Like I can see that, especially when you hear Bobby Webster, what he said after the fact as well, in relation to the reaction that, unlike some of the other teams at the draft, they don't give the guys they're about to select a heads up at all. It's like they want the surprise. But for Murray Boyles, you also got to understand that we're going to have cameras in your face, and we're going to parse every little muscle movement in that face. You better look like you're the happiest of all time. Don't do the Connor McDavid thing, because it's going to make people nervous. But I do buy it. Like, yeah, it's a huge moment in your career, and it's an F not because, this sucks. It's an F because, oh my God, it's finally happening. Am I a sucker? Like I actually believe him.
No, I mostly believe him, but I also, like, I gotta be honest. I think it's like he's selling us a little bit, because I saw, so there's that one he did. I also saw the sit down he had. I don't know if this is like actual on the broadcast. I saw it floating around on Twitter last night with Taylor Rooks, and it's like he was still collecting himself. Like that was right on the draft floor. He's like, yeah, man, it was definitely like WTF. He just said that like four or five times in a row. So I think he was still kind of working on the messaging there. I would say Raptors, and I wouldn't say this for most NBA franchises. I love the surprise. I love seeing a guy actually find out in the moment. I love that we still get guys crying in a world of NIL where these guys are like kind of millionaires or, you know, closer to it when they get to the league. And I don't begrudge them that, but it's not the same step that it once was. We don't always get the emotion. Maybe the Raptors should be the one team telling players.
Yeah.
You're the one team. You might want to give people a heads up. Like, all right, let's workshop this. I'm going to put a camera in your face. Why? We're about to draft you. What? Okay, don't do that. That was bad face. Let's try again. Like, I think that's the one team. The Raptors have got to start giving these guys a heads up on that.
I'll push back. I think it's great that we get the actual real reaction from these guys, because I don't care. I'm done being insecure about the Raptors. There are so many incredible Canadians in this league, and this Raptors team just won a championship 6 years ago. You don't want to come to Toronto? You don't want to come to Canada? You don't want to be a Raptor? I want to know, because I don't want you here. And I don't think that's the case for Mr. Murray Boyles. But no, I want to know exactly how you feel, or I want to be able to parse it. Oh, you don't want to be here. Oh, you want to go to Charlotte? Okay. Or you want to go to Philadelphia? No, listen, more than happy to send you on your merry way. Like I'm cool with getting the reaction, because I'm done being insecure about this team and the players that don't want to be here.
No, I do like that. And just for the record, it's like you would say, fine, then be a Brooklyn Net, just like the odds is the way work. Yeah, it's like he'd be like, okay, honestly, that's the problem. It's like this one particular draft. It's like, Brooklyn. I think it's like not the end of the world.
Yeah. A couple more things from the draft. Obviously, Cooper Flagg going first overall. And the fans were at American Airlines Arena to watch his selection, still chanting "Fire Nico," which I get. Like, you still good. Like it's still this doesn't undo the trade. Like, imagine you had Cooper Flagg and Luca, which I guess is a weird scenario because Luca came back from injury, probably not finishing where they did. Anyways, but and he's still responsible for Luca and the minimal return that they got for him. I understand it, but shouldn't you be moving on? Like, isn't, as far as losing a franchise player, as devastating as that is, shouldn't you be heartened by the fact that the lottery balls fell the way that they did, and you have potentially the next great one? And I don't think that this is like even likely, but boy, if this is not like an Andrea Bargnani first overall selection. This is Cooper Flagg, somebody that is projectable and he does a few other things that Luka doesn't, mostly on like the defensive end, and it seems like potentially a more team oriented fella and a more dedicated person to his craft than maybe Luka. Luka, love him. Got him all the way to the finals. But if you're a Mavericks fan, should you not be moving on to feeling good about your franchise as opposed to still harboring the resentment towards the general manager, which made the horrifying move?
No, why not both? This should be, if the Mavs still exist 300 years from now, they should be chanting, like, you know, sometimes when the Leafs go out to Edmonton, there's like the dueling, like, let's go Oilers, go Leafs, go chants. It's like, that should be, let's go Mavs, fire Nico. Like, it really should be something that is just a part of the history of this franchise. I remember going to like TFC games when Danny Dicciel wasn't, I don't know if they're still singing the song, but it's like, they got a song because he scored the first goal in whatever minute. Good. Yeah. Don't stop doing that. And I want some kid in Dallas 100 years from now being like, Dad, who's Nico? Why do we chant about firing him? I love that this is like a part of their identity. So no, he just because the NBA rigged the draft lottery, maybe sort of for him, doesn't mean he's off the hook for his terrible Luka Doncic trade. So no, I completely disagree on this. The NBA lets teams have 27 alternate jerseys now. They should have a jersey that's just Nico's face with a big old X on the front of it as a service to the fan base. No, I love this. Lean into this forever. Don't ever for one second let that guy forget how bad he is at his job because of that one fateful phone call that he just had to make to Rob Lowe, a.k.a. Palinka.
There's Cooper Flagg on the dais hoisting the Larry O'Brien trophy over his head, and then, with the NBA
Nico
final.
Nico sucks!
Like, Nico Harrison's still there because he's reset the timeline here. He just did the league's dirty work for them right before the Lakers were about to be sold. So obviously he's not going to be fired. Even if he were, he'd be like, he'd be Adam Silver's right-hand man. He'd have a job somewhere. But anyways, he's reset the timeline because the future is bright once again for the Mavericks. Yeah, there he is celebrating an NBA champion. Fire Nico?
Well, no, because then I think, like, let's just say, okay, like, pie in the sky scenario, Cooper Flagg is everything we think he is, but he's more. He's actually LeBron, and he's in the finals with, Kyrie and Anthony Davis. It's like, then it just turns into, like, a funny thing, and he's in on the joke, and he's like, yeah, Nico sucks, like, drunk at the parade. No, I think there's, I think this must become a core tenant of Mavs fandom. Like, they should be selling shirts in the team shop about how bad he is at his job. No, they got to lean all the way into this. And I will just say on Cooper Flagg, it's like, not a guy I've heard speak a lot. Like, sometimes there's the LeBrons of the world and they're ever present. Sometimes it's like Cooper Flagg is just a basketball player now. Seeing him up on the dais, they're asking him such like incredibly lofty questions. Like Kevin Nagandi asked him why he feels people connect with him as a basketball player. And he's like, I'm 18, but he was actually able to give like an incredibly eloquent answer about how it's the passion of his. And he understands that there has been, maybe a lack of incredible great Americans. And he's maybe hinting at like a specific subset of Americans. There hasn't been a ton of, and I honestly, like, there is going to be a lot on that kid's shoulders. And in that moment, I'm like, maybe, and I don't say this is a knock, but like, maybe he can handle it, honestly. Cause that was just like, it was just, it's one thing of like, tell us about your game. Is there a coach that you remember from, eighth grade YMCA ball? And it's like, why are you the great hope for America, Cooper, and why do people love it? And he had a half decent answer. So, man, good on him.
Good for him. I mean, he's had lots of time to prepare for that because this has been the guy for a couple of years. Last thing, the most insane.
I have one more as well, but you can go. Okay. You can go first, last.
I think the most insane moment of the draft was when the team that went 21-61 gave up an unprotected first round pick for 2026. That's just me to move up 10 spots in the draft. The Pelicans did that to move from 23 to 13 to select Maryland's Derek Queen. Again, they went 21-61, not like a couple of years ago. It's not like a built like last year. They have Zion, but he's like on the verge of having too many 4-liter bottles of Pepsi and being 800 pounds or all his bones rupturing because he's like the heaviest man in the NBA. They gave up an unprotected first round pick. Like, you couldn't get even like a top three protection on that bad boy. That's insane.
Like top one. Like, just ask for it. What are they? They're going to blow up the deal over top one protection. And honestly, it's like just a fit thing. It's like, I don't know, the shorter, stockier center is like the great fit next to Zion. But like, we will get to that here or there. I don't care if the fit was perfect. You do that deal for like Cooper Flagg, and that's about it in this draft. So yeah, that was pretty nuts. Could not believe that for a second. But I can, because it's the Pelicans, and bad teams, like, you know, good teams make good decisions and you trade for good players and sign good contracts. Bad teams, they do bad team things, and that absolutely is one. My last one, Will Riley selected last night, Kitchener's own. This guy could not stop shouting out his hockey mom. They're like, and what did you do to my mom? She's the best. She's a hockey player. And I just, God, and she's just the sweetest Canadian girl. They had her on the broadcast there. I loved everything about that. So awesome that a Canadian being drafted in the first round is like, yeah, who cares? It wasn't even first overall. It's very telling of the place we're at now. Shea got the shout out at the start of the draft talking about how, hey, it might not be the first guy. So yeah, I loved that moment. And I love that a Canadian getting taken is, just a thing that happens. And we maybe are starting to almost take it for granted, which is kind of crazy, but it's also telling of the place we're at as a basketball nation.
100%. That's why I don't care if the fella the Raptors select, and I'm not saying Colin Murray Boyles is it, but if they don't want to be here, get the hell out. don't need you. I do think he wants to be here, though. He's just he was overwhelmed by the moment, so he let one slip, as is his want. All right, when we come back, Max Scherzer, I guess today's the big day. How's the thumb responding after throwing 80-plus pitches yesterday? We'll talk to Shai Davidi, who was there for his second outing as a Blue Jay, next as the Fan Morning Show continues. Ben Ennis, Brent Gunning, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.